Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Mullen, joined by John Roering, Jack Spencer, Simon Schuster, and Abigail Walls. A little later, the new House Minority Leader, Sam Singh, will be joining us to talk about the upcoming session. But first, guys, we haven't even banged the gavel on the new session yet, 99th session of the state legislature, and we've already got a hot topic to talk about. We're going to get rid of the income tax, yes?
Yes, apparently, according to Senator Jack Brandenburg, he'd like to play with different concepts about how to replace it. It's a very tall order, though. Kyle, you and I have been through this a number of times, I think, where people have talked about replacing the income tax. It would be one thing if it were a small tax, but it is such a huge number, it's probably almost insurmountable to accomplish.
$9 billion from the budget. You know, Jack, the first thing I thought about, remember Fulton Sheen and the flat tax? It's kind of the same kind of idea, isn't it? You get rid of all taxes and you just have an enormous sales tax?
Well, yeah, it's based on that kind of idea, but the one that I connected it to was trying to get the money for the highways and for the road repair, because you know how much problems you have there, and you have an actual situation where you've got to get it and how long it took them to come up with the money to do it. And in this case, it's a theoretical thing on how much better this other kind of tax situation would be. But if you think it was hard to get the road repair money, this is just completely out of reach, realistically.
It sounds great politically, doesn't it? I mean, it's kind of like thinking, boy, I'd really like a Mercedes-Benz, like one of those cars they're showing at the auto show. I'd really like something like that. And then slowly come into the reality of, I'm not going to be able to afford the payments.
Well, there are states that don't have the income tax, and they do quite well. The problem is, how do you get there from here? You have to come up with a replacement, just like with the road money. How do you replace the money, you know, with the various schemes where you are going to change things around? It's kind of like starting in the middle, whereas I think other states got to start closer to the beginning when they created their tax structures. And it's just kind of like you can talk about it and talk about it, and it's kind of like you end up arguing like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
And the other problem that state lawmakers have to think about too is if it's all sales tax, it's going to be fine if the economy is humming along and we're expanding and we're growing. The minute we have an economic downturn, though, you don't have any stability. The income tax at least gives you a little more stability to counter the volatility that'll come with a sales tax.
Let's think about the special interests in this town, too, if we go to a sales tax, because that would inevitably mean we'd have to broaden the base, right, which would mean expanding it to services. I think we remember what happened the last time.
That was a fun debate. That was a fun debate. The list of services that were going to be exempted was long.
Yeah, so you start getting into services and expanding that, and all of a sudden you think that we have a lot of special interests in this town. Just wait till you crack open the sales tax on services. You'll really see how many we have.
Yeah, I think that there's a remarkable similarity between this the floating of an income tax repeal in Michigan and the idea of repealing Obamacare in Congress. You know, both of these Republican parties, both nationally and here, have experienced affirmative elections where they want to bring some of the sweeping change that they ran on. But the issue is that they can bring that change, and everyone agrees that, you know, change should be made. But the question is whether the pill that they're going to have to swallow as the replacement for that change is something people are going to be amenable to. And then the sticky part there is that then that party has to own that change.
Well, and I think that's a good pivot here, because there is a little bit of ownership that would take place, right, Jack, if the Republicans were to repeal Obamacare.
Well, yeah.
And because it'd become their issue now.
Well, this is the thing that's been remarkable, I think, on the Obamacare issue, is that the right, the political right, has done an incredible job, I think, over the past 6 years of making people forget how much the American people hated the health care system prior to Obamacare. It's kind of like suspending reality in people's memories that all of a sudden this thing was thrown on us and everybody suddenly hates Obamacare, but they hated the previous system. There were all kinds of problems with the previous system. And I do believe, we keep talking about, we keep hearing, well, President Obama's legacy is out the window. He's not going to have anything. They're going to get rid of all of his executive orders and they're going to repeal Obamacare. But I think that's inaccurate, because I think he is still going to be remembered for Obamacare, because prior to Obamacare, you did not have the Republicans talking about actually doing anything. Now that we've had Obamacare, it's been repeal and replace. And that is totally different than where they were 8 years ago.
Replace, John.
Can you say Trump care?
Trump care.
How many Democrats across the country want the Republicans to repeal this and replace it with something? So suddenly it's a Trump care issue, something that they can run on in 2 and 4 years. Because no matter what you do with this system, it is so intrinsic to the lives that we all have that any change is never going to be a love system, just like Jack said.
Because there's always going to be high cost. Your insurance is always going to go up.
It's a bureaucracy. It's something you have to untangle. Your copay costs are always rising. Costs are always rising, no matter what you do to it. I mean, you can slow the rate of increase, but nobody's ever going to love the creator of the healthcare system.
What's your thoughts on this topic, Abby?
There's some point, some validity to what John says, but I think at some point people do get, it's the instability that becomes politically untenable. You can only push the football back and forth so many times, and you can only change the law so many times before the general public gets sick of just the instability of it, especially the person who doesn't qualify for the Medicaid expansion but is still certainly not working the kind of job where they can handle major fluctuations in where their income is going, especially if they have children. I think there's a point at which this becomes tiresome. But, you know, there are provisions that as we move through with Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, that are just going to become less and less feasible. Healthy Michigan, you know, is a great program for those that qualify for it, but the enrollment was more than double what the state anticipated. Mm-hmm. Problem with that program is it's great. Get more people covered. However, the states that have the higher number of enrollees are also the states that have the lower revenues and are less likely to be able to fund this program down the road as the federal government draws down what it's going to kick in.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point in that when you take a look at Obamacare, what do you actually get rid of here? Because when you start breaking it up in pieces, then politically it's like, well, geez, do you really want to get rid of kicking kids off their insurance by the time they're 26? Do we really want to end that? That was pretty good. What about pre-existing conditions? That was actually, us Republicans, we actually thought about doing that as well. And then you bring up getting rid of the Medicaid expansion. And then it's like, do we really want to kick all these people off Medicaid? Because how many of these people who now get the expanded Medicaid voted for Trump in the first place?
And I really think you can't gloss over the ripple effect. Healthcare is extremely complicated. And just the Medicaid end alone, I mean, healthcare plans, providers, they apply to the state to have certain coverage areas, and those coverage boundaries will shift and change as the requirements for Medicaid shift and change. And honestly, the person that's qualifying for Medicaid really can't afford to keep up with whether or not their insurance will be valid in Genesee County, but not one county over, or Ingham, but not Eaton, and that's one whole city, you know?
I think that the challenge for Republicans now is that they have run on a platform of sweeping change, a sort of rejection of the Obama administration policies. Whereas the Democrats, when they were running, they sort of viewed Obamacare as a half step, and that they needed to finish the work that Obamacare had begun. Because, I mean, this is a 2,200-page piece of legislation, and right now it just looked like healthcare policy troubleshooting. And so the question is going to be now for this party is that whether they can tear it all down and fundamentally build it from the ground up, or rather augment what is already pre-existing. And I think that, like, especially with an income tax repeal at home, it's going to be a question of how amenable the administration in charge, being our governor, is to that.
All right, so we're going to circle back to the income tax replacement. We all kind of downplay the reality of getting rid of the income tax. So what is the upshot? Is there an upshot here? Or is there just kind of a sobering moment when the governor presents his budget and everyone thinks, geez, things are really tight right now. This is just going to be another, you know, year-to-year budget. No big moves can be made. No big spending can be made. No big tax cuts can be made. It's kind of a stay-put budget. And then this idea of the income tax kind of flutters away.
Well, how do you even start to get rid of the income tax? The logical way you would do it is you have to put into the statute or whatever it is you're changing the new way you're going to get the money first. So who's going to agree to those kinds of things on the sales tax and everything else? It's kind of like putting the cart before the horse. You have to just talk about getting rid of the income tax and not talk about how you're going to replace it. So then you have to get some kind of agreement on what we're going to replace it with, how many people are going to go along with all those kinds of things on the sales tax, on everything in the universe, on services and everything else. And you have to put that in place first, and then you get rid of the income tax, and it just becomes, you know, I think it's politically unfeasible. You're not going to get agreement on what you're going to replace it with to even get the ball rolling.
Sounds like you're sticking a fork in it.
Well, yeah, I don't think there are very many people who'd bet a lot of money on this happening.
I think if they attempt it, they're going to waste an enormous amount of time an enormous amount of political energy for something that's not going to get done.
Thank you, guys. We're going to move on now to the interview with House Minority Leader Sam Singh. Join us now on the podcast as the House Minority Leader, Sam Singh. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Well, what are people going to notice differently about a Leader Singh as opposed to a Leader Grimal?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm going to be focused on is not necessarily different than Leader Grimal. It's going to be focused on really some core principles around economics. I do feel that the Michigan economy has gotten slightly better for businesses, but the average Michigander hasn't really felt that. And as we go forward over the next 2 years, we're going to really be talking about that. How do we make sure that the benefits that businesses are seeing in the economy actually goes down to that level of the individual, and how do they see that benefit? And so you'll be hearing me talk more about those issues. I'll continue to talk about the budget priorities that the state of Michigan has that is not consistent with what the Michigan citizens want. Continue to talk about how we're underfunding K through 12 education, higher education, worker training programs, and those are going to be some really key areas that we'll be focused on.
Tax changes. Do we need to make any?
Well, you know, I was surprised to see, you know, Senator Brandenburg's proposal to take billions of dollars out of the state budget. You know, right now we're underfunding our roads, our infrastructure. We have obviously the issues that are facing Flint, facing our public schools, and to talk about removing revenue when we haven't fully funded the areas that every citizen cares about, to me, doesn't seem to be the right set of priorities.
What about any tax changes?
I'm always open to looking at any proposal that's forward. You know, that'll be something that we'll consistently look at. But at this point in time, when you can take a look at 6 years where we have underfunded education, the governor has a report on his desk that he commissioned that basically shows that we've underfunded that area. You take a look at our higher education funding, the cuts that were made in 2011, we still haven't caught up on that. We're going to see a lot of strain on our general fund budget because of decisions that we have made as a legislature. You're going to have an impact with some of the changes that will happen in the federal government that are already being talked about by the new administration. So how do we resolve all of those issues? And so I'm always open to having a comprehensive conversation, but if it's an idea that immediately takes revenue off of the table, that means it's going to continue to hurt those areas that we haven't fully funded yet.
The Committee on Committees has been meeting and are going to be making their recommendations here soon. Have you had any conversations with soon-to-be Speaker Leonard on your recommendations on the Democratic side?
Yeah, we've been having conversations at the end of last year as well as the beginning of this year. I think they've been very good conversations. I'll be presenting a similar list. My Committee on Committees has been meeting. It's been led by Representative Winnie Brinks. I think they've done a really good job. We will be presenting that shortly after we get sworn in to the new speaker, and I look forward to getting committees up and running. I think there's a lot of policy issues that are facing the state that we need to begin to grapple with, and obviously the first thing that will be on the agenda will be the governor's budget message that will be coming out in a few weeks, and that will be an area that I want my appropriation members to be focused on when that becomes public.
And I'll talk about appropriations in just a minute, but do you have an expectation that Leonard will say yes to all your recommendations? Do you have that commitment?
Well, we've had conversations that I thought have been very fruitful. I've kind of shared with him my philosophy. He shared with me his. You know, I'm very confident that as we go forward, we'll be working in a strong partnership. So
this isn't going to be Cott or Grimal too, is it?
No, I think, again, you know, Tom and I have a really good relationship. We have known each other, obviously, for the past 4 years as legislators. We're here from the same area in the same region. I think we also want to take back some of the older traditions that the House has had that we somehow lost with term limits. And so I think you're going to see a more collegial relationship that Tom and I are committed to doing as we have our own areas of dialogue. And there will be times that we will battle. And that is part of the legislative process. That's always been the history of this institution. But there's also a way to then collaborate and work with each other after that battle is over. And that's something I'm committed to.
Why is it important to have a collegial relationship
Well, I think we have really tough issues that we're facing. You know, one of the things that I'm most concerned with is President-elect Trump and some of the decisions that he's talking about making that potentially could cut hundreds of thousands of people off of Medicaid that will have a direct impact on who we are and what we provide as services. Obviously, we expanded Medicaid here in the state, 600,000 people there. Those are going to be some really tough issues that we're going to have to grapple with. And so for us to be able to work together, to be committed to looking at bipartisan solutions on some of these very difficult issues, I think is important. And this institution has had if you go back to the 70s and 80s, when I take a look at my mentor, Lynn Jondal, and you talk about, they had disagreements, but they would often come together and do some of the best policy together. And I'm hopeful that will be where we end up over the next 2 years.
Talk about the appropriations process, because you've been a part of that since your time here in the House. Do you feel like something's lost in the subcommittees, and has it become a top-down kind of arrangement and as far as developing the budget?
Well, I've been just somehow, somewhat surprised that subcommittee chairs oftentimes relegate their responsibility all the way up to the chair. When you take a look at the 90s when I was interning here at the Capitol, a subcommittee chair really ran their subcommittee right. And made their decisions. And I guess in term limits, you see that change happen. At least last 2 years, I saw that to be really evident. But to me, my hope is that we can get back to more deliberative process. You know, I've been disappointed with the majority's decision to bundle up all of the appropriation bills when it comes onto the House floor. I do think we should take a look at every single subcommittee's report and vote on it up or down, you know, on the House floor versus what they've been doing over the last 6 years. But we'll see how Representative Cox wants to run the committee. I've worked with her very closely. I served on one of her subcommittees, and so I know we'll have a good working relationship there.
Have you heard from the governor personally yet?
We've talked, obviously. You know, energy policy was a big issue as we dealt with the final days of lame duck. And so our conversations that I had with him were more specifically dealing with the lame duck issue of energy.
Do you think we're going to get back to quadrant meetings, like regular quadrant meetings?
Well, I would hope so. Again, I think there's always better policy when you have all leaders at the table. I think there were a lot of missed opportunities by the fact that you didn't have regular meetings of the quadrant. Again, if the governor is committed to having the legislature as a true partner, then it's not just the majority. It's also those of us on the Democratic side of the equation. And so if he is open to that, I'm willing to participate and put my time and energy into that, because I, again, think the best solutions are bipartisan solutions. You can see that on the energy policy. I think we had really strong commitment on everybody seeing something positive come out of that. And that was because Democrats were involved in the process. When you take a look at, you know, some of the decisions that were made in the end about DPS or the Detroit Public Schools, when this kind of philosophy of Republican-only policy moving forward, you saw really bad policy come forward. Obviously not things that the governor wanted. And so, you know, my hope is as we go forward that it'll be more bipartisan in nature. But again, the governor has to make that decision. But I'm willing to be part of that process if that's the way he wants to go on his last 2 years.
Your philosophy as far as being in the minority, is being in the minority something that you should be proactive or reactive?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think obviously with a number of key issues, we're going to have to be reactive. When you're taking a look at new changes that will be coming from the federal government, from the Trump administration, things that could really dramatically be hurting Michigan citizens, we're going to have to react to that. It's not just Democrats who are going to have to react to that. The governor is going to have to react to that. Republicans are going to have to react to that. But you'll also see us come forward, as we have in the past, with policies that we would like to see implemented. I was pleased that we did get a number of bipartisan bills and a lot of Democratic bills across the finish line and into public acts last year. But again, the economy is not working for people. And if you want that to really be part of the legacy of this institution, we have to get back to that. You know, a number of Republicans ran on that. The president ran on that message. And we want to hold them to account. If you think you want to, you know, support these middle class workers who've been disenfranchised, let's do that. Let's put that back. So we have to deal with things like the unemployment insurance issues. We have to deal with with worker retraining. We have to get the earned income tax credit back. You know, it's one thing to run on these issues and say that you want to help people, but then when the first set of policies you start taking a look at in lame duck are about taking away people's pensions or retiree health care and so forth, to me that didn't make a lot of sense. And so we're now in a new session, and I'm hopeful that this majority will take a look at those issues, because many of them ran on that, and at least their presidential candidate did. And if we want to truly help Michigan citizens, will be there. And if they don't want to, we'll definitely highlight that and show our own bills of support for those individuals.
If Tom Leonard came to you and said, Sam, I'll give you one bill this year, you can have one piece of policy bill and we'll go ahead and pass it, no questions asked, what would it be?
Well, you know, I'd go back and taking a look at our bargaining rights here in the state and dealing with a number of issues that deal with right to work and the ability for people to organize. But, you know, to me, I think there's a number of things that we can focus on. The earned income tax credit, I think we can get our K-12 budgets back. I think we've been balancing the state budget on the backs of local communities. $6 billion taken away from local communities, and that's why we have problems with our pension and long-term liabilities in those communities. So there's a lot of things that we can work on together, and so my hope is that we'll be serious about those issues. You know, the treasurer did say while I was on appropriations that the way we fund municipal government is broken. I want us to fix that. You can't go out and just take away retirees' benefits without helping those local communities be able to generate the revenue that they need. $6 billion has been stolen from those communities to balance the state budget. It's time that we actually take a look at how we help those communities.
But if you got one, it would be repealing right to work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are some fundamental rights that people have here in the state that was taken away. But to me, again, the focus can be on a lot of issues that we can work on together.
2018, Gretchen Whitmer for governor, yes?
There's a number of people that are going to be running for governor. Gretchen is a good friend and is somebody I've known very well. I think she'll be an ideal candidate there. But I also know other names, people like Dan Kildee and others that have put their name forward as the lead of my caucus. I'm not going to spend too much time focused on the gubernatorial election. I'm focused on getting my caucus ready for the 2018 elections and picking up seats and moving us back towards the majority.
All right. Sam Singh, the House Minority Leader, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here. I almost didn't recognize Simon Schuster today because he's got glasses. I stared at him for a long time wondering if we had a new employee or... But no, it's just Simon in the new glasses and a new haircut and a newer wardrobe.
Yeah, he's got wool pants on today, too. He's just stylish.
Wool pants?
Yeah.
Boy, I didn't even notice the pants. I haven't even gotten past the face yet. I didn't even know it was Simon who walked in here.
Yeah, I got a complete overhaul this weekend, and I had to visit the new Warby Parker location in downtown Detroit and picked out a pair of specs.
Pretty soon he's going to be like Jacob when he first started. Remember the complete transformation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, where he had his hair was kind of brushed forward, and now he's bearded
up. I think
up.
Somebody even put a picture on Facebook of Jacob with
the swoosh hair last week.
Ooh, that was
swoosh
a nice...
Hair, is that Jacob, a, is it, swoosh yeah, hair, is that up here?
He had flow or whatever.
That was a great picture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that got a. I mean, that looked like something right out of the 80s. Facebook, Jacob Kanzler,
no, that was like,
with
it was
a
like
K.
An opening sequence of Unsolved Mysteries.
So I remember when John Kennedy brought in the fashion of not wearing hats. I know that was a long time ago, and a lot of people probably don't realize this, but prior to John Kennedy, JFK being elected, men always wore hats, just like in the old black and white movies.
Kind of like what you're doing today.
Yes. Well, that's because it's cold. but and we're not talking about baseball caps either. We're talking about, you know, the classic business type hats that people wore. And now you have this new president being elected out of a surprise coming in. And my question is on this fashion thing, is it going to now become popular to try to wear your hair the way that Donald Trump
did? Revival of the comb over.
Maybe, yeah, I'm almost losing my hair. Maybe I should give it a whack.
Well, you might want to work on that there.
End up being the first lady, Jack. I think that's better chances.
I concede to you the fashion.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know if I'd call our President-elect's hair a comb over so much as an elaborate cover-up. It's moving in a lot of different directions.
All right. Well, we're going to end on that note. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.